there something that's kind of replicable? And to what extent do you think across the region there's other people paying attention and going, actually, maybe there's something that we can learn from this?
My bullish case, and this is really just this is the best case scenario. So long as she sticks to the bread and butter issues, labor, wages, the economic populism, the protectionism and the nationalist bent that's traditional to the Mexican left, I think that she should be successful, even if there is even if a kind of populist right surges out of nowhere.
Right.
You think, because people's material conditions really have improved drastically.
Everyone, welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of history. I'm Alex Hokuli in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and today I'm joined by Juan Rojas, who's a columnist at Compact Magazine covering Latin America. He's also a contributor to American Affairs, and he was on previously, you may notice, talking about El Salvador a couple of months back. Welcome back, Juan.
Thanks for bringing me back on, Alex.
So Juan is joining us from Mexico City. Mexico has just elected its first woman president, Claudia Sheinbaum, who's a secular Jew. And as a consequence, she thanked Jesus in her acceptance speech, though it's, I think that's actually Jesus, which is her husband's name.
Yeah, exactly. So
Claudia Sheinbaum is going to be Mexico's new president. She's a Jewish climate scientist from a communist background, which seems designed to trigger QAnon types. It's great.
But
Claudia intends to extend the legacy of her predecessor, AMLO, who was actually anything but a stereotypical left liberal. You can hear a lot more about him in our recent episode, our election preview, which we did with Roger Lancaster, that came out last week. I would encourage you to check it out, because what we're going to do here today is not cover the same ground at all that we covered with Roger. So it's kind of different themes, which we're going to pick out, some about kind of political economy, about Mexican conservatism, various other things besides. So we're going to get on to all of that in just a second. So just a quick announcement for listeners who aren't all familiar with BungaCast. A new episode of ours comes out every Tuesday with additional episodes on Thursdays and Fridays most weeks. Two episodes a month are free, such as this one. All the rest of our content, to get it in full, you need to sign up to patreon.com/BungaCast. On there, we have episodes with the three Bungabos, myself, George, and Phil, as well as our regular contributors, Alex Gurevich, Catherine Liu, Amber Lee Frost, and Lee Phillips, and episodes with writers and editors from Damage Magazine, with whom we're partnered, which also means that if you subscribe to our Patreon, you also get a free subscription to Damage Magazine, and there's always great stuff being published on there from a range of different perspectives. I highly encourage you to check it out. So that's all at patreon.com/BungaCast. Just an announcement for those who are longtime subscribers. Thank you for being with us. But we'd like to let you know that the old tiers are being phased out. But if you'd like to upgrade for just $2 more a month, you get double of what we used to put out. So putting out four paid episodes a month, which are only available there. So it'd be great if you joined us. What you may have missed over the past month, just to let you know, if you haven't been following us that closely, we debated pro-Palestine protests. We, in the Reading Club, our exclusive Reading Club, we discussed Isaac Deutscher's monumental biography of Joseph Stalin. We had the renowned music critic Simon Reynolds on, talking to us about future music and about whether the contemporary high-tech music is all that futuristic. After all, we had Roger Lancaster, which I've already mentioned, on to talk about Mexico, about populism, corruption, and class consciousness in Mexico. And we had two episodes on kind of, I guess, political films about Alex Garland's Civil War and Jonathan Glazer's zone of interest. So coming up in June, we've got lots of international stuff. We've got this episode on Mexico, which we're going to get into the meat of in just a second. But we are also going to be talking to Achin Van Eyck, one of the sharpest critics and analysts of Hindu nationalism, talking about elections in India, which are just wrapping up now. They've gone on for like 6 weeks, multi-phase, seven-phase elections. And we're going to be rounding up what's actually gone on there and what the prospects are for, for Modi to hold on for, you know, through his term and beyond. We are looking at South Korea and the fertility crisis there and increasing gender strife. That will be out later this June. We're talking to Sam Chris about a whole range of issues, about polarization, about politics, and about Saudi Arabia and Saudi modernism, and why Saudi presents a vision of modernity and modernism, and why it might be actually rolling back on some of its ambitions. In the Reading Club, we're talking about the structure of post-Soviet Russia, and we are discussing also energy with Fred Stafford and the structure of American energy markets and why they're all so fucked up. All that to come, and we'll also be dealing with your questions and comments in our regular Alpha Bonus. Okay, that's enough previewing. Plenty of stuff to be excited about in June. We hope you'll join us for that. And now I need to ask Juan, who's sat patiently through these announcements. I want to ask you, because you've been in Mexico City for the past week, what the vibe's been there, what the election, has there been election fever, as people like to say, and what's been the vibe once the announcement of the results came in?
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess I should say that I've only been in Mexico City. I wanted to leave the city to get out of the capital, but unfortunately, time did not permit. The opposition's a bit stronger here. Morena did win by 10 points, but you're more liable to get upper class, middle class perspectives that are a lot more critical of the government. That said, I mean, there was a lot of adulation, and I was also here for the Claudia's campaign closing, the Cierre Campaña in the Zócalo. And there's like 1 million, 2 million people. It was really quite something. I almost got crushed against the wall. Wow. Not quite. it was good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, this is the continuation of a government. It's not a new government coming in, although the president is changing, and there has been an overwhelming victory in Congress and in both lower and upper houses. So maybe run us through what the results look like and what that means in terms of legislative possibilities for the new Morena government.
It's really just stunning. Claudia got between 58 and 61% of the vote. They're still counting. I think the latest count I saw had her at like 59. They apparently are going to come up 4 seats short in the Senate of a supermajority, but they will have 2/3 control in the Chamber of Deputies. So, I mean, this is just huge. Of the 9 governorships up for grabs, they won 7. Including wow. Yucatan, which is a traditional PAN stronghold. I mean, really beat all expectations. The polls had her at around 50%. Some of them. So it's really a remarkable victory, especially for a left wing government. You know, I mean, it's in Latin America that right now kind of have been in the doldrums.
No, absolutely. I mean, I'm trying to think of other examples where not only has the sitting left-wing government won another term, but had such an overwhelming hegemony in Congress and the legislature, because that you can think of examples like Lula's victories in Brazil and winning 4 straight terms for the party, but they never had the sort of
max 10% in Congress.
Exactly. Yeah,
it's a big deal too, and really, all the financial media and a lot of opposition media is going crazy right now because they essentially will have a supermajority. I mean, which is 4 seats they could be able to negotiate. AMLO had this; they were kind of campaign pledges in the beginning of the year, a list of constitutional amendments he wanted to pass. Passed one actually that would allow workers to receive 100%. Of what they used to earn in their pension, of their salaries as a pension, and a lot of other eccentric ones too, like constitutional ban on vaping, which we can get into. It's really
the real evil.
Exactly. But the more controversial one is he wants Supreme Court justices to be directly elected and cut funding for the INE, the Electoral Institute, which it was actually a bit troubling at one point. They took an eternity to announce the rapid results, which is unusual. I mean, even in the really contested 2006 election, they got the official results out pretty quickly. So Claudia ended up giving her victory speech at like 1 a.m. and it was a very short speech. So, but last thing, it's interesting, the congressional term here in Mexico, it starts 1 month before AMLO leaves office. And so this is why they're going crazy, because, oh no, this tyrant might be able to push through some of these reforms before he gets out. So you're going to hear a lot of Democratic and backsliding in the media.
Right.
Right until he leaves office.
Most of it, which has no foundation. I mean, they've won the support of masses of Mexican people.
Fairly and squarely.
So, I mean, just we're going to finish, I think, this conversation talking in a regional context about the extent to which AMLO, Morena, Sheinbaum, maybe Buck, kind of regional trends, to what extent it represents a model, etc. And also place it in the context of what is probably, largely speaking, a kind of still a pretty conservative moment across Latin America. So we're going to be talking about that towards the end. But just a little bit of that right now before we get into a whole bunch of other stuff. One of the interesting things is that there hasn't been the right wing opposition is still pretty socially liberal, socially progressive. Unlike in a lot of Latin America, it tends to be, I guess, you know, you could characterize it as sort of progressive neoliberalism, right? Kind of right wing economics and kind of, you know, left liberal sociocultural policy, to the extent that, you know, actually the contrast is that AMLO has represented a kind of a slightly more traditional, let's say, if not conservative, social policy. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah. I mean, it's really strange, especially here in Mexico City, because there are progressives on both sides of the, you know, let's say the alliances. I mean, really, it wasn't just Sheinbaum and Galvez, though they were the ones that got the most votes. There was also you talked with Roger about this party, the Movimiento Ciudadano, which broadly, and especially with the candidate that they picked for president, they got 10% of the vote. Pretty progressive overall. He was promising to decriminalize drugs, wanted to keep all the social programs, expand them too. Basically, the election was all between different forms of progressives. Galvez, the thing is, she was heading the main opposition alliance composed of the PAN, PRI, and AMLO's former party, the PRD, which on paper is left wing. So she actually on paper came from the PAN, which the PAN is traditionally conservative, has like a Catholic bent. There is a hard right sector of the party that has met with Vox and is friendly with, you know, kind of the populist right abroad. But they're just so debilitated. And you can really chalk it up to AMLO himself, because he is just such an idiosyncratic, odd character. I mean, I love to use the vaping example because it's just so perfect. He uses a lot of moralistic, religious rhetoric, but it's something the normal Mexicans, especially outside of Mexico City, see as in keeping with their values. I mean, and it just drives the opposition insane every single day, Monday through Friday. His mañaneras, it's like he'll just wake up in the morning and think, okay, what can I, oh, look at these kids, these hooligans. What the hell is it that they're putting into their bodies? We need to stop that. I don't know what it is, but it can't be good. So,
you know. Right, so he kind of outflanks everyone, kind of is able to straddle the political spectrum, at least kind of the body of mainstream opinion while still retaining what is fundamentally a kind of central left policy.
Yeah, no, because his leftist agenda in a populist sense, it's all just for the people. So raising the minimum wage, banning subcontracting. I mean, it's really stunning what they've done. They've raised wages by a total of 35% during the 6 years he's been in office. This is just bread and butter stuff. People have just seen their lives improve. But the point I've made about why there's no hard right here in Mexico, it's odd because the result ended up being that the election was between, different shades of progressives. Gálvez, though, did have a platform on economics. She wanted to kind of reopen the energy sector to foreign companies. That was a reform that EPN did. AMLO's successor was disastrous. It led to oil production declining drastically with Pemex and electricity prices actually going up. AMLO's had this effort to try to renationalize the sector by force in a way. But Gálvez, campaigned in favor of abortion rights and LGBT rights. All of the candidates did. This kind of populist right figure, Eduardo Verástegui, kind of a Bolsonaro-type figure, although what's funny is he's a former soap opera actor, tried to run for president, barely got 1 to 2% of the vote. It's really unexplainable when you look at it on a regional level.
That's interesting. I mean, it is very interesting. It's interesting why, Mexico was standing out. Now, I'd like to put Mexico in context, in historical context, particularly in political economic context. So let's kind of rewind a bit and try to situate where Mexico is and how it got here over the past sort of 20 years, 30 years. So I think, at least in the Anglosphere, we hear a lot about the effect of NAFTA and free trade on the U.S., and particularly the effect on U.S. industrial workers who lost jobs, lost leverage over their employers when their factories moved south across the border. But we probably hear less about what the effect was in Mexico, other than, these maquiladoras, these kind of factories and assembly lines opening up in Mexico. And that would seem to be good for Mexico. Indeed, the way that it's, I think, presented in the U.S., particularly a lot of populist discourse, whether from the left and the right, this was all to the benefit of Mexicans and to the detriment of U.S. workers. And the story is a little bit more complicated than that. You tell an interesting story about, how this, about these effects and the kind of political economic dynamics that have taken place in Mexico since the mid-90s, in particular in a piece which is linked in the show notes, your essay on these matters in American affairs. Mm-hmm. Basically, and maybe I'm asking you to kind of explain this out in more detail than I'm about to, but basically Mexican agriculture was destroyed and went to the U.S., whereas U.S. manufacturing moved to Mexico, but also moved to China. So the picture is not a simple kind of zero-sum game. Tell us exactly what the effect of NAFTA was for Mexico.
Where to begin? I'll start here because I just tweeted about this, actually. There's this incredible graph from InfoAI of the inflation-adjusted minimum wage here in Mexico. And, Mexico in the 1970s was a very prosperous country. I mean, some years, 10% GDP growth. And you look at the minimum wage, it was extraordinarily high, actually higher now. Right now, it's only caught up to maybe two-thirds of what it was then. And a lot of that was because of the oil boom then. Mexico was and still is an important oil producing country with the state oil firm Pemex. So it's one of the most important oil firms in the world, although it's extremely indebted. But you get to the 1980s and there's the Volcker shock, which causes this debt crisis. The country really goes into haywire economically. The 90s are even worse. It just becomes decades of stagnation. What they figured was, hey, let's try to industrialize. We are going to grow our manufacturing sector, and NAFTA will help us do that. Well, how will it help us do that? It is, okay, you sign a free trade agreement with the United States. That allows you then you know, wages in Mexico were a lot lower. But the thing is, especially after the 1980s, policymakers took the deliberate decision to suppress wages. They stopped raising the minimum wage and let it fall, and then it remained stagnant for 20 years between the 90s and up until 2018. That was a boon to NAFTA, because the reasoning behind that is, hey, it's cheaper to manufacture in Mexico. All right, let's bring all this industry from the U.S. here. The downside, however, is that so it was negative in that sense for the U.S. I forget how many jobs were lost, maybe 600,000 or a million, something like that. But a similar amount of jobs in Mexico were lost in small agriculture. Peasants in the countryside could not compete with subsidized U.S. agricultural products. It just became impossible and were completely run out of business. The state of Michoacán, for instance, was extremely negatively affected and became one of the primary migratory states, or emigratory states, I should say. Consequently, millions of Mexicans went to the United States. You look at it, and Mexican immigration began around the time they enacted NAFTA. This is, I mean, it's too convenient. It's, you can't chalk it up to anything else. The terrible thing then is that after 2000, China joined the WTO, and this just destroyed Mexican manufacturing. So Mexico, the country, was just hit with a 1-2 punch, and now has been starting to benefit because of these trade tensions with China. Companies are now interested in moving back to Mexico. And unfortunately, a lot of it is actually Chinese products that would have gone to the U.S. directly. And now we're just, Mexico has become a third way country.
Yeah. I mean, and so that kind of the story of, which is the case very much across Latin America, of deindustrialization. Brazil has suffered greatly from that. Various other countries have as well. Mexico seems to buck that trend, but again, it's assembly for U.S. manufacturers. It's not kind of Mexican-owned manufacturing.
I'll say two things on that. My diagnosis as to really Mexico's problem and what they could do to further their development, they need to develop their own firms. As you said, it's really just product assembly. Mexico is an assembly colony. All of these plants and the maquilas, it's for foreign companies. There is no Mexican Samsung or Mexican auto company, etc. To be fair, after the initial shock in the 90s and after the early 2000s, I would say that the maquilas, it's allowed the country's economy to be fairly stable. Growth has been incredibly low, like 1-2% for decades. But it has been stable. It's been more impervious to external shocks, especially in commodity prices, like happened to Brazil.
Yeah. No, I mean, the migration question is very interesting once you put it into this context as well, because what would have happened otherwise if there hadn't been this outflow to the U.S. mm-hmm. is probably, you know, the development of kind of far more urban Mexican economy, which is what happened elsewhere. But of course, with Mexico, there was a case of, and the opportunity to go to the U.S. So that's what happened there. And it acts as a kind of a release valve, I guess, for Mexican politics, not for Mexican politics, but for kind of Mexican society as a whole. Now, I'm going to ask a question, which I really should ask this in every single episode we do, or certainly every episode we do about various countries' politics, which is, how is geopolitical competition, especially but not limited to the U.S. and China, affecting Mexican economy and politics and maybe even society and culture? Now, maybe there isn't a clear answer to that, or maybe you don't have a perspective on that at this stage. But I'm saying this because I'm going to keep asking this across a whole range of episodes, because I think it is the fundamental question of our times.
Mexico has a really interesting foreign policy. Traditionally, it's always been part of the non-aligned movement. That's still the case, even under AMLO's predecessors. It was more inclined towards the U.S., but on paper, they've always had that doctrine. AMLO is, you know, a very combative figure, and he likes to be provocative. For instance, there was this military parade where, like, the all of the countries that Mexico has relations with, you know, paraded like their soldiers, and the Russians were there, and that freaked out a lot of people in Washington. What they said was, hey, well, you know, the U.S. troops were there too, and so were X or Y countries, etc. But at the same time, AMLO's actually said things like he's not interested in de-dollarization. And this makes perfect sense. I mean, going back to NAFTA, the reality is that since NAFTA, Mexico's economic fate, and I mean, you could say geopolitical fate more broadly for far longer before, is inexorably linked to the United States. It's yeah, you can't really, for Mexico, it doesn't make sense to, for them to say, oh yeah, we want to start using the yuan more. It's just not viable. On the other hand, well, yeah, they, especially under a left-wing government, again, yeah, AMLO especially likes to be provocative. He's been sending a small amount of oil to Cuba. It's kind of a humanitarian gesture because of the island's crisis. This infuriates my neighbors in South Florida, but
So, I mean, one of the curiosities of AMLO's period in power is his kind of bromance with Trump, if that's not too strong a way to put it. They always have nice words to say about each other. I particularly like Trump saying, you know, he's very loyal to me. Oh, but also I've been very loyal to him, making clear that it's not just a one-way street. AMLO even called on Mexican Americans to vote for Trump's primary opponent, to not vote for DeSantis.
To not vote for DeSantis in the primary.
So, we're going to talk about U.S.-Mexican relations more broadly beyond these two figures, but I wanted to start there because I wanted to ask whether their, you know, romance, whether that was a coincidence of interest simply, or whether it's a personal relationship, but which doesn't go really beyond that, or is there some kind of at least partial alignment on ideas and vision?
There's a lot to say here. I think it's a bit of all of those things. You look at it, well, first of all, this surprised a lot of people. Number one, because AMLO is left wing in a lot of ways, and he is, whereas Trump is conservative, and I guess you could debate that too, or he puts on a facade. but you think, oh, this shouldn't work, and especially because Trump has this line against, you know, radical leftists, especially in Latin America, Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, and others. But on policy, even. But stylistically, rhetorically, on a personal basis, they have a lot of similarities. But on policy, they do as well. They both are very keen on energy sovereignty, oil, extraction. They're protectionists. They both despise NAFTA. Obrador had been campaigning for decades on renegotiating the agreement in 2006 when he first ran for office. That was one of the big things that scared everyone. And they said, oh, no, we can't possibly renegotiate our free trade agreement with the United States. Trump, since the 1980s, had been saying stuff like that. And so this is purported. We don't know for sure. But supposedly, from the moment they met, and they met early on after AMLO's victory, before he had become president. As president-elect, he was party to the negotiations to renegotiate NAFTA into the USMCA. And so someone from Peña Nieto's government said that, Trump saw in AMLO, it was like looking at a mirror, and he called him Juan Trump. And then beyond that, they both despise the media. They have this incredible animosity with the media and both of their and international media, because the international outlets also hate AMLO. It's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I guess
Obrador was one of the last leaders, along with Bolsonaro, to recognize Biden's victory in 2020, and he sees in Trump the lawfare that's been waged against him, he sympathizes because he sees himself in that. In 2005, Vicente Fox tried to disqualify AMLO over this bogus lawsuit against him while he was mayor of Mexico City. He created this huge media furor, and yeah, he almost won the presidency. Then there was a lot of allegations of fraud. It was an incredibly close election. So Trump, there's a good quote of him. With Megyn Kelly, an interview with Megyn Kelly, he said,
Obrador, a nice guy. He said the same thing happened to him. They stole the election. Something like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess they're both, you know, at least in reference to the political systems and the way that things normally align, kind of heterodox figures. So I guess there's a kind of mutual understanding there, at least. I wonder how that will play out with Sheinbaum, assuming that Trump gets reelected. Sheinbaum is a far more, I mean, at least on paper, seems to be a far more orthodox figure in terms of, as I say, you know, kind of climate scientist from the kind of professional classes, has a more kind of traditionally like left-wing communist background, I think. Cut her, you know, got her political chops through the student movement, right? I think as well. So I think it's just something which is a little bit more, I guess more orthodox in considering, you know, the kind of political spectrum today.
Yeah. Let's see. So she was never a communist. Her father was a registered member of the Mexican Communist Party during the 1960s. And they were active in protest during the Dirty War. The military here in Mexico killed hundreds of people. The infamous Tlatelolco massacre in 68, something like 400 students were gunned down by the military. Sheinbaum says that her earliest memories are visiting her parents in jail.
Right.
So, she has a long history in leftist politics. I would say that, you know, that was such a long time ago. I don't think she's necessarily a Marxist, but she followed and her parents were scientists like her, physicists, also something like that. She first studied physics and then like energy engineering. So she went into academia, but was active with student movements. She joined the PRD, AMLO's former party, in the early 1990s as part of its youth wing. And she very consistently, since the 80s, 90s, has been a huge opponent, for instance, of privatizing Pemex, Salinas's neoliberal reforms. It's something she refers to this day. So we can talk about this also, the successor curse in Latin America. I don't think that she should engage. She'll engage in like a full 180, like a Lenin Moreno in Ecuador, who, right. If listeners don't know, Rafael Correa, popular leftist president, left office, and his handpicked successor stabbed him in the back, not just politically, but just went over to the opposition and governed as a right winger. I don't think that would happen, and so what troubles a lot of people is the Brazilian case, what happened with Dilma Rousseff, and who knows? We'll really have to see what happens when she governs, when she's president. But in terms of relations with the U.S., she's shown some signs of pragmatism, or at least people on her team have. This is only one thing, but I think it is important. Ramon de la Fuente, who I think was Mexico's UN ambassador, he's seen as a likely foreign minister pick for Sheinbaum, openly criticized U.S. asylum policy. She and both him have said that they're interested in cooperating with the U.S. on immigration. And so de la Fuente said, hey, like, guys, you just let anyone apply for asylum as soon as they enter the country. I think his quote is like, the second someone touches ground in the U.S., they're eligible for asylum. This is obviously an incentive for people to go to the U.S. So that I think is heartening.
How do the politics of migration play out in Mexico? Because Mexico is not just a country of origin, it's also a transit country for a lot of migrants from Central America. AMLO was happy to, it seems, or certainly at least acceded to demands to halt that flow as much as possible. The military played a role in trying to stop the flow of migrants from the rest of Central, from further south in Central America through Mexico to the U.S. How do the politics play out? I don't really have a sense. And what are the constituencies in Mexico around migration, if there is, what does the debate around it look like?
Yeah, it's a really complicated, interesting issue. Obrador, and I forgot to mention that. Yeah, Obrador and Trump, they got along also because they're both transactional figures, and so essentially the deal that they came to, Trump agreed, hey, look, we will like not criticize anything having to do with how you govern, your security policies, etc. We will respect your sovereignty, whatever, in exchange. And also, we will respect your energy priorities because AMLO had this push to essentially renationalize the energy sector, buying up private enterprises that had entered the country under EPN. And in exchange, Mexico would agree to clamp down on immigration, chiefly in its southern border. And so in 2019, Obrador created the National Guard and sent thousands of troops to the border with Guatemala to repel migrants. Since then, things obviously changed with Biden, et cetera. And remind me again, sorry, there was like a second part of your question.
Well, I mean, how...
How the politics, right, yeah, play out here. It's hard because you have to think, I said this in another podcast, what are the incentives for Mexico? You have a ton of migrants from foreign countries, some of them from way far away from African countries, the Middle East, et cetera, China too, that get here and just traverse your country trying to get to the U.S., the easiest thing is to just let them pass through. Mm. I mean, it costs money to deport people, pay soldiers to repel them, bus them. You know, one thing that they're doing right now, actually, crossings have gone down a lot in 2024 because the Mexican government, they started increasing deportations and also taking migrants in the border with the U.S. and busing them back down to the border with Guatemala. It's kind of a half measure that will eventually make their way back up. What I've said on that note is that if the U.S. wants greater enforcement for Mexico, they need to literally pay for it or do something for Mexico in exchange that they want. On the other hand, Mexico does have an interest actually in stopping people from entering through Guatemala. Why? There are a number of negative outcomes that come from having millions. I mean, yeah, something like 8 million, 6, 7 million that have gone through Mexico to the U.S. in the past 3-4 years. It takes time to get through Mexico. A lot of these are Venezuelan migrants. They'll work in Mexico for lower wages. That'll suppress wages for native workers. They'll have to house them. This is especially complicated with Remain in Mexico, because then you have to you keep all these migrants in the Remain in Mexico. It was suspended by Biden, but under Trump. And this is actually smart in a way. Under Trump, you'd have to stay in Mexico and apply for asylum here before going to the U.S. And actually, in a sense, that does give you an incentive to stop the migrants from coming in the first place, unfortunately, by force. If you look at polls, and something like 60% of Mexicans say they don't want, for instance, more Haitians or Venezuelan migrants from coming into their country. Anti-immigration sentiment in Mexico, like around Latin America, I wrote a piece about about immigration policy between Colombia and Venezuela for the Telegraph, actually. That talks about this, but in other countries as well, anti-immigration sentiment has soared. Why? Because there is so much migration now through the region. Mexico used to be one of the most restrictive countries in terms of immigration, especially with Central America. The number of foreign permanent residents from like Honduras was lower than those from Spain up until like 2020. So the total of permanent foreign population of non-American, there's a lot of Americans living here as well, but of Central Americans, Venezuelans, Cubans here in Mexico, it's like over a million, 1.3 million now. And that's led to a lot more animosities towards those groups.
Right. And this question has been, to a certain extent, militarized as well. And I just want to touch on this briefly. We talked about it with Roger Lancaster in the kind of election preview episode. How is that playing out? And will Sheinbaum continue the use of the military to fulfill certain policies? I mean, a lot of it is infrastructural development, which the military has been tasked with dealing with, but also, you know, policing the borders, policing in general, and indeed perhaps policing kind of drug cartels as well. So the military plays a large role. What is your view on this? What is your perspective? What risks do you see with the use of the military?
Yeah, this is a really complicated issue. I have no issue with them building things. And actually, a friend of mine, an author, works at he works at a university in Puebla, was explaining to me that, hey, look, actually, before Obrador's government, Mexico really hadn't built anything significant in decades. And AMLO's had these huge infrastructure projects, the Tren Maya, the interoceanic train, the Dos Bocas refinery. A lot of them are way over budget, but that's kind of normal. But they're really coming along. And a lot of that, and other infrastructure throughout the country as well, a lot of that is because of the military. Their budget has shot up, but the reality is that you really were only going to get a lot of these things built through the use of the military. And you look at the history of the U.S., a lot of infrastructure was built by the U.S. Army Corps of Civil Engineers. Panic, because the critique against militarization comes exclusively, essentially exclusively from like centrist and center-left critics. For some reason, I mean, I think it's obviously more productive for the military to be building things as opposed to just killing people.
Right.
But at the same time, the military here in Mexico, it's essentially a parallel state, has been for a long time. Under the PRI, they had the party itself too had a symbiotic relationship with drug cartels.
Yeah.
And they were traditionally very right wing. AMLO's actually been able to win them over. I think the Navy is still very right wing, but the Army is very much in favor of Morena. A lot of that has to do with the fact that the average soldier gets paid the minimum wage, which has gone up in real terms 130%. So obviously they're going to like the president. But there's still a lot of abuses in the countryside, for instance, by soldiers, which is of peasants, which is an odd thing for a leftist government, you'd think. I spoke actually with these kind of fringe Marxists near the Zócalo, this party that's called like the National Front towards the Fight for Socialism. And yeah, they explained to me how in like southern states, for instance, there's still people that are run out of their homes. A member of theirs was accused of killing a soldier in 2007, and he had been detained without cause, and they finally charged him last year without evidence. So, this is a fringe group. I don't actually know the details, but a lot of what they told me, and I spoke with like Indigenous Union as well mentioned that too. They said that there's been less abuses than in recent years, but at the same time, the government's banner was to rein in bring to justice a lot of abuses under previous periods by the military. The horrible, sad, and actually, I think this is probably, other than security, AMLO's biggest failure, the Ayotzinapa massacre, which, if listeners know, 10 years ago in 2014, 43 students were disappeared, later found to have been killed, almost certainly by the military. There was a huge cover-up, and there was a commission set up under the current government. It was extremely bungled, and in the end, they actually ended up reaffirming the original narrative that EPN's investigation into it found, which is just completely bogus. And the obvious reason for this, like I said, is because the military is a parallel state. They basically just vetoed this measure. I'm about to finish. So long term, this could be very, very bad.
Well, so I mean, this is a very interesting question, which we're not going to resolve now, but it's something to keep an eye on through the course of Sheinbaum's term, which is what is the kind of military's role in infrastructural development? Is that a way of curbing the kind of neoliberal anti-developmental tendencies, or does it set up problems for the future? Does it increase the military's role in political life? Does it set it up as a kind of parallel state, which it has been in many ways throughout kind of Mexican history, or indeed bolsters the authority of the generals and feel that they might be have a greater role to play in politics? So I think there's a lot of concern there. I think it's quite an interesting thing to keep an eye on. You've already mentioned security, so let's turn there.
I'll say this. The answer is it's both of those things.
Well, okay. Yeah, as it often is. But on the question of security, because this also segues nicely from these questions, security doesn't seem to have played out politically as a key issue in this election, which maybe is one of the reasons why the field in this election was all broadly kind of fairly socially liberal, I guess. There was no hard right, law and order kind of candidate, which maybe if you're a listener elsewhere in the world, you think, well, that's kind of normal. But in Latin America, that really... Not in Latin America, because Latin America, no matter whether the kind of hard right law and order forces are in the ascendancy or not, they're always present. And they're present everywhere. They're present even in countries which maybe they haven't had such an important role, like Argentina recently. Even Milei was able to lean into that to a certain extent. So Mexico, again, an example which really stands out from the rest of the regional context. Last time you were on, we were talking about El Salvador, where Bukele has locked up.
He was just sworn into a second term, actually, right, as Sheinbaum won.
And Mexico, it has a security situation which is perhaps less chaotic than maybe some of the kind of TV makes it seem, because the levels of violence are very concentrated in certain states and certain areas. It's not
a huge country. I mean, the caricature that people say, oh, Mexico, dangerous. I mean, yeah, sure. But this is like, I mean, you can say that even about American cities. So some U.S. cities are actually, there's a lot of U.S. cities that are among like the top 10 most dangerous in the world in terms of homicide, St. Louis, Baltimore, et cetera. But within those cities, there are even safe areas. It just depends.
Yeah. And so Mexico's kind of, there's no single kind of national picture by any stretch of the imagination anyway, but the backdrop is still one where there is a lot of criminal activity, high homicide rates, and indeed kind of non-state organizations, which really challenge the state's sovereignty over its territory, particularly the kind of drug cartels. So how was that playing out politically in Mexico? Was it a feature at all of the election?
Yeah, no, it definitely was. And Galvez did campaign. I mean, it wasn't like super like Mano Ura or anything like that, but she did campaign on a tougher line, that she would take on the cartels head on, whatever. I mean, it's paradoxical because Obrador ran and actually been saying this for decades, that he wanted to return the military to its barracks, that the problem was militarization that caused the outbreak and violence. People also, this is left out in the headlines, before 2007, Mexico had a homicide rate equivalent to that of the U.S. at a national level. Sure, there's petty crime, et cetera, but homicides were pretty low and had been going down for a long time, which is also strange considering that the cartels have been around for a long time. But Felipe Calderon, who won in 06, as soon as he became president, because presidents in Mexico are sworn in office in December of the year of the election. So a few months into his term, he declared a war on drugs, a war on the cartels, this militarized assault on all of these drug trafficking organizations. It caused homicides to skyrocket into the levels that we see today, and essentially have remained stagnant ever since. And that's a critique that Morena and Mexican leftists continue to make, this, hey, it was them that caused this. It's true. It's true. It's not false. The problem is that, as we discussed, militarization has continued. And it's very incoherent because, okay, we're going to continue using the military. And I mean, in a way, this makes sense. Yeah, I mean, the cartels are heavily armed. But what they've done is that the idea is that they'll be used as more of like to restore order, a kind of a peacekeeping role. So whenever there's an outbreak of violence, they'll just send a ton of troops to X area to try to quell the fighting. And that can actually work to an extent. But so they're not targeting them directly or going after doing the kingpin strategy, which is also terrible because you'll just kill or extradite the head of this cartel, and then there will be infighting within the drug trafficking group or between others. So there will be a power vacuum, and it's a disaster. But the current policy also hasn't worked that great. It's also a PR nightmare because the amount of seizures of drugs has plummeted. So it's something that really upsets people in the U.S. I mean, in the aggregate, unfortunately, that doesn't really make a difference either on the net flow of drugs. But, you know, you want to be able to show results, especially to Washington. There's so much that we could go on forever about this. But I will say, according to government figures, and there's a whole fight over the data, you could do this in any country, honestly. But in Mexico, there's more scrutiny. Homicides, the government likes to credit this to its policy, have gone down 10%. They're still extremely high. But one thing that people on both sides, critics and proponents, will point to, for instance, was the capture of Ovidio Guzman, El Chapo's son, last year. I think in 2021, 2022, they tried to capture him. And this led to a nightmarish scenario in Culiacán, Sinaloa. They let him go. And the reason they let him go is because in the way that particular operation had gone, they were surrounded and it would have led to a bloodbath. And to their credit, when they then captured him in 23, they were able to do it in a less bloody way. So I guess it's humanitarian, sure, but on the other hand, they were humiliated by having to let him go. It's a lose-lose situation.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's a tricky issue, and one which this podcast needs to do a dedicated episode on it, which won't be now, but something for the future. So kind of reaching towards the end here, there's obviously I want, first of all, to get your view on Sheinbaum's prospects and how you see that playing out. Because as we said, just to kind of resume a little bit what we've said, you know, huge electoral majority, widespread support, the ability to not just pass laws, but potentially even pass constitutional amendments. Really a lot on her plate and a lot to play with. And a way of continuing and perhaps even radicalizing some of the progress that was made on Ramlo.
She wanted to.
So, you know, there's obviously the important points about, you know, expanding oil production or increasing the minimum wage, et cetera. And that could all be extended. Again, not a revolution, but a bit of progress in a regional and even global context in which there's very little of that. So that all looks interesting. But at the same time, some things which might come undone for her. And we've already mentioned a couple of them. There's the issue of migration. There's the security issue, perhaps most presently and most concerning of all. So, I mean, how do you see it playing out? You've already mentioned the kind of successor syndrome. Perhaps it won't be a situation where she'll kind of do an about face and a 180 and turn against all the accomplishments of her predecessor. But maybe things come undone. How do you see it playing out?
This is redundant to say, but I've said it a ton of times. I'm both cautiously optimistic and cautiously skeptical. Why? I think that no matter what, she will govern in a more conventionally progressive way. And I think that that will inevitably lead to the rise of more of a hard right, either in the midterms in 2027 or in 2030.
And by convention, let's spell it out. What is conventionally progressive, right? I mean, we've talked about how AMLO has been relatively heterodox, maybe a little bit more traditional on certain issues, was, didn't advance on abortion rights, for example. In fact, said he would put it to a referendum. So in a lot of these social questions has either said, we'll just put it to a referendum or not really sought to advance in any way. He's made some enemies even in kind of culturally liberal social movements. What would Sheinbaum's approach be if it's more traditionally progressive, if you want to put it that way?
She's, a champion of LGBT rights, was on a UN panel for climate change. She was AMLO's energy secretary while he was mayor of Mexico City. And, she really has never gone against him on anything, but she'll be in charge now. And she said that she doesn't want to see Pemex go under. She wants to refinance its debt, but wants to do a lot more to move towards an energy transition, which actually Mexico has been one of the poorest performers on that front. Obrador really doesn't care that much, although there's been some expansion, solar panels and whatever, renewable energy. The problem, though, is because he's a nationalist and has wanted to retake over the energy sector, a lot of the renewable energy is from private companies. And so they've been kicked out over the course of his 6 years. And that's also infuriated environmentalists and climate activists. The Maya train caused some environmental problems with the cenotes and stuff like that. Sheinbaum, though, she's been by him side, by his side so long. As mayor of Mexico City, I cited a Bloomberg article that said that she prioritized development infrastructure projects in the city over the concerns of activists. So who knows? I've talked to a number of people that say they don't think that she'll go in the really like climate fundamentalist direction. But it will definitely be a greater priority of hers. And there's no way that she'll be able to maintain, just at least rhetorically, let alone on policy, Obrador's heterodoxy on social issues. I mean, he's a bizarre figure. I mean, he's like promoted a record number of women to his administration. And actually, like LGBT legislators as well. But he's a traditionalist. He is not comfortable with LGBT issues. The Supreme Court actually decriminalized abortion in 2021. And he just he didn't really say anything about it. Yeah, his position had always been he wanted to put it up to a referendum, which up until recently would have meant that it would have failed, abortion rights would have failed, I should say. He says that, and this is funny because it upsets conservatives. He says that, you know, he talks a lot about the family, quotes the Bible. That's not what upsets conservatives. What upsets conservatives in the U.S., I'm going to get to, but He says that because Mexicans have such strong families, that's why there's very little drug consumption in Mexico, whereas in the U.S. there's been a lot of disintegration in the family. And you can find this on Twitter. There were a lot of right wingers that were just going berserk because, oh, it's because of all the people you've let into our country. You're right, but it's because of all the people you've let into our country. So he drives just the media crazy with all of this stuff. I mean, the vaping example is a good case. Let me say one last thing on the vaping thing, actually. It's something that drives libertarians insane, especially because you think it's something so inane. But what's funny is that in a lot of ways, Obrador also has cut the state. It's more activists and protectionists, which infuriates them. But they don't like that he wants to ban vaping. But on the other hand, the number of employees and a number of key agencies has gone down drastically. Their salaries cut.
Right. Sheinbaum going to continue this so-called Republican austerity of trying to.
She says she wants to. We'll have to see. Her program is basically to just keep doing all the same things. The main difference, though, is on these progressive issues and climate stuff.
So one last question here, just to round this out. How much is the Mexican situation and the context in which Morena has been able to achieve such remarkable results, how much is that something which is just specific to the Mexican situation, to the course of its historical development, that it reached a point in 2018 where people were ready for something more progressive, where that was able to be institutionally, where that this party was able to be successful, or is there something that's kind of replicable? And to what extent do you think across the region there's other people paying attention, going, actually, maybe there's something that we can learn from this?
My bullish case, and this is really just this is the best case scenario from a progressive perspective, from a conventionally progressive perspective. I think she will govern as more of a conventional progressive. So long as she sticks to the bread and butter issues, labor, wages, the economic populism, the protectionism and the nationalist bent that's traditional to the Mexican left, I think that she should be successful, even if there is even if a kind of populist right surges out of nowhere.
Right.
You'd think, because people's material conditions really have improved drastically, and that might be something we could finish off on. But on the other hand, things could go bad. I don't think that she can replicate at all her predecessor's charisma and heterodoxy, and I think that would make her more successful, because just think about it. It's one thing just that you have someone that's looking out for you, but people also feel as though the president shares their values.
Mm. All right, excellent stuff. Look forward to Sheinbaum's sextennial term, and to see what she does with the congressional majorities that she has available to her. And hopefully, Mexico continues to be a sort of positive, relatively speaking, positive example in a region of which there seems to be very little of these days.
Yeah.
Juan, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, Alex.